Hello and welcome to this episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. In today's episode, I talk to Afshin Moayed. Afshin is a partner at Razor Capital, a venture capital firm focused on early stage investments in emerging markets, particularly Bangladesh and Southeast Asia. With a career spanning roles as a founder and advisor, he has been integral to projects in diverse sectors, including tech-enabled commerce and embedded finance. Based in London, Afshin leverages his international experience, including time as a board member at Ireco and past leadership roles at startups to back high-impact, growth-oriented entrepreneurs. In today's episode, we talk about big opportunities in big populations, why Bangladesh is a well-kept secret, how there are 40 million climate refugees in Bangladesh by mid-century, and how 15 million people a year are joining the middle class in the region, how to move the growing aspirational population from climate victims and contributors to the other side of the scale, and how low-cost wins, often the external view of emerging economies, value can actually be found in other ways. Maybe 15-minute grocery delivery does work, but maybe in different markets, and how density equals distribution. Finally, we talk about Afshin's contrarian conviction that it's okay to own up to your mistakes and that there is no financial benefit in being right. Let's get straight into it. This is Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah, the podcast where I talk to the people behind the stories that make the venture capital ecosystem go round. I've been working with startups from pre-seed to Series C for the last decade, and companies that I've worked with have gone on to realize value and exit or raise funds in excess of $500 million. I really hope you enjoy the episode, and if you have a guest that you'd love to see me have on, or you have a comment on any of the episodes that I've recorded so far, do reach out to me on LinkedIn or Twitter. I'd love to hear from you. Let's get straight into it. Hello and welcome to another episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today in the studio with me, I'm super excited to have Afshin Moayed. Afshin is a partner at Razor Capital, a venture capital firm focused on early stage investments in emerging markets, particularly Bangladesh and Southeast Asia. Afshin, really great to have you in the studio with me.
Well, Arish, thank you for having me. Pleasure to be here.
No, amazing. So we're going to start off with a quick fire so our audience can get to know you a little bit better. I will be watching the clock, but what was your first job?
So I was sweeping floors in a factory.
Okay, going to dig into that a bit later maybe. What did you do before you got into the tech and venture ecosystem?
Well, like most people, I guess I was an operator. I gave it a shot at running a startup for better or worse. It's baptism by fire.
Yeah. And so what triggered your move into building Razor?
So funny enough, I always thought I would be a researcher living in Latin America in a previous life. Or when I was romanticizing what to do that was purposeful out of university, I guess I got the continent wrong. and I figured out that doing something meaningful in the venture capital space and helping entrepreneurs be successful in emerging markets, they are people we do not cover enough.
Yep.
That don't get the resources and the help we can get here, and they are all incredible in their own ways. So yeah,
That was one of the reasons I decided to launch this podcast, to be honest. And what do you think you'd be doing if you hadn't built Razor?
Oh, well, if you ask my parents, I was probably going to do further studies and either have a boring desk job somewhere, or probably I would have ended up in Latin America, but okay. I don't know what I would be doing.
I'm really keen to understand this Latin America connection, having spent some time there myself. But before we get there, why don't you give me the elevator pitch for Razor Capital? What's the AUM thesis, check size? What are
sure.
you doing?
So Razor Capital, as you said, we invest in emerging markets. We believe in big opportunities with big populations, solving problems that are a reality across geographies that apply in Bangladesh and Vietnam and Indonesia, Philippines, which was our core focus. We started with Bangladesh, now we're going across. We back regional companies. We believe that, again, if you solve a problem, you know how to address it, the borders are not going to restrict you. Now, these days, we invest across climate, cross-border trade, future of commerce, and embedded finance.
Okay, amazing. And if you were to think about three companies from inside or outside your portfolio that you're excited about, what would they be?
So there is a microinsurance company in Philippines that I really like. I'm impressed by the founder, the maturity and the diligence of the work. It's a company called RuralNet. Again, haven't met many founders with that degree of wisdom and calm and composure, especially when you're dealing in emerging markets. So I would like to have some of his energy. I think another company that I've always kind of had an admiration for is not in my portfolio, that has been able to do things that others are still figuring out how, is Shopee and SCA Group. I think to be able to build an e-commerce player that is not bleeding cash in markets that are tough to reach, I don't know what the secret sauce is. Some people say it's because they're gamers initially, but that's a different topic. And a third one that we're excited about, I think one company we backed in Bangladesh that, again, I really like the impact, which is called iFarmer. It's a fintech business helping financing farmers and helping them increase their income by offering them the services they need, like from finding the right input and helping them get access to finance, which is another thing.
Amazing. And one final question, just to keep you on your toes. Okay. Given the Latin American connection, what's your preference, ceviche or a nice curry?
Oh, God. I think as much as I like the ceviche, the nice curry is something special.
Yeah, I guess a lot of us would probably say the same. Anyway, Afshin, thank you so much for joining me. We're going to get into a lot of detail in the main podcast for the time being. Thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you for having me.
Excellent. Right.
Sorry, I did not cover everything. Check size.
That's fine. With that, we'll obviously be posting your company links, etc., so people can go to it's not a massive issue. Okay. Go have a slug. Afshin, really great to have you in the studio with me. Thank you so much for joining me.
Well, thank you for being here, and a pleasure.
Okay, amazing. Well, we're gonna dive straight in. So let's firstly talk about Razor. When most people look at the Southeast Asian markets from a venture perspective, you wouldn't be surprised to hear them talk about China, India, or Indonesia, amongst others. But Bangladesh probably doesn't come up too often. So break the opportunity down for me, if you would. What are the key factors that excite you about it? And equally, you are now considering Vietnam and Philippines as you expand regionally. Similarly, what has caught your attention that maybe hasn't been on the radar for others?
Okay, so many things to uncover together. I think Bangladesh has something unique going for itself as what other people would conceive an issue or problem, right? Mm-hmm. You have over 170 million people in a very small landlocked country. I mean, landlocked because they have mostly India surrounding it and a small border with Myanmar, which is not a stable one. And then you have the Bay of Bengal.
Yeah,
it's not a place that is easy to access, although historically has always been a prosperous part of Asia and the subcontinent. Now, obviously, its recent history over the last century and the last 50 years has not been an easy one, but they've shown as a people, as a country, that there's a middle way between individual endeavors, collective like forces coming together and building a nation and a society. I think the hard work, the persistence and all the values they represent in their work on the daily and over the last decades is testament of that commitment. What I personally like is that they're forward thinking in terms of how they want to build their country and the future they want to give their kids and grandchildren. You don't get to hear that often. It's usually people looking back at where they came from, where they want to go, or how they've lost their stature in the world. I think in Bangladesh, it's mostly the opposite. So it's like, we're excited about the future. And I think that's overall a great mentality to have if you want to build something. Now, it's not always that easy either. Probably you have to stay optimistic. If you're in a place with 170 million people with the highest density on Earth as a country, there are other cities that are a bit more dense than Dhaka, which is hard to imagine, but I think that also brings with itself a unique opportunity. Bengali or Bangladeshi, depending on where you stand on the question, is the eighth most spoken mother tongue. Oh, so wow. It's a huge market. It's overlooked. I mean, Bangladesh is a have bigger population than Russia.
Yeah.
But these are not preconceived ideas when you're
here. It's almost three times the size of the UK population.
Yeah. Exactly. And they're mostly young.
Yeah.
Right? The majority of the population is under 30.
So middle class, aspirational, growing youth.
Exactly. So if we put a bit of a macro hat on that and we look at the demographics and how people kind of got out of extreme poverty, I mean, we can compare lifestyles. That's not the point. But if you look at their earning capacity and where the trajectory is going, something's happening.
Mm-hmm.
And we kind of had a unique access by having Bangladeshi friends mm-hmm. who were born and raised there, who had lobbied us in terms of, you should come here, you should come here. There's something that's happening. It took us a while. Well, we studied the numbers. We went on the ground. And I think it was a great experience between kind of matching the view between what you perceive and, let's say, what you see with your own eyes and the numbers you're reading, and mapping that one above the other.
And so you didn't have a connection to Bangladesh before?
I'm not Bangladeshi. I mean, yeah. I had Bangladeshi friends at yeah. university, but they're East London Bangladeshis,
right.
Which for other Bangladeshis is
so
a
you're,
whole different
you're Lebanese,
world.
Is that right?
No. Well, my background is Iranian, but Iranian, I was born okay. and raised in Luxembourg. So okay. it's, funny enough, one of my high school friends had gone to Bangladesh in 2010. And I wondered why.
Okay.
Then, at the end of that decade, I was the one going there more frequently. So I guess it's a well-kept secret.
Yeah, yeah.
The image of the country is not one people have in mind. I think they're not good at marketing. It's not like Dubai. And I think they should definitely learn a thing or two from Dubai on this. But I think Bangladeshis, as a culture, they're very humble. So they were not good, put it on the forward as much.
Mm.
And I feel that it's about making themselves known a bit more. Now, we know that, well, there are a lot of people. We would know when there is a typhoon or something bad happening or a factory falling apart. So it's the negative sound bites that are there. But negative sound bites don't define a people, a culture, a place, and what's happening.
Also, it depends on who's writing the article, right?
Who's
reporting. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a whole different topic. But you can cover that. But again, having those voices being represented, so the best way is you go and figure out yourself. So that's what we did.
Mm-hmm.
Now, funny enough, as a team, we had all operating experience and investing experience. My partner Osama, who was like the first one and who launched it all, had also experience investing in US funds.
Mm-hmm.
And it was not such a great experience. So the whole idea, why don't we do it ourselves? Why do we, obviously it's a whole different experience investing in Bangladesh than in the US.
Mm-hmm.
But there is also an aspect of being able to work with a portfolio company and also generate real value instead of paper value that is depending on a other future buyer to validate more or less the work that has been done.
And previously. Presumably there isn't a huge amount of follow-on capital in Bangladesh itself.
No, exactly. I think that's the next challenge. I think when we came in, there were signs of early stage investment in terms of seed capital. We came in at Series A. That's where we're comfortable, really bring the structure in, help build up the operations, bring in the governance, structure things, make them look as clean as you can, making it as presentable, bringing people abroad, professionalize the outfit at the end of the day. That's the goal. The challenging part probably is that, let's say you raise some money, you're getting the numbers, you are able to grow, but you still have to be careful on how you spend your capital compared to a company here where we say, well, we raised and we grow. They're growing, but they're keeping a foot on the brake because you don't know where the next capital injection is going to come from. And your goal is to become break even or at least cash flow positive early on, even as a startup, because there is no alternative.
Yeah. So a couple of things within that, right? So for founders and entrepreneurs in Bangladesh, are they looking elsewhere for that capital? I mean, is it a closed network or is it a fairly open ecosystem from that perspective?
I think it's the way you approach it is the right one. there are different layers to it. So first, you're probably going to go like everywhere else, knock on doors of friends and family. So that's going to be the first kind of group you're kind of. So there is a community in Bangladesh. There are angel investors, but you cannot expect five people to kind of seed the whole market at early stage. Thank God there are multiple different angel investors that really have kind of carried the torch for everyone. Now they also want to see returns. I think it's on the entrepreneurs, the first one who took the money, to also bring it back so that they can keep recycling that. I think that's something people need to learn. Like everywhere else, it's not about the alpha 10 years down the line, but maybe you have an exit after 3 years, 4 years, 5 years. If there is money on the table, bring it back, because it's going to benefit everybody. I think in terms of the community now, there are, let's say, the more international crowd in Bangladesh, and there are the VCs that are coming having a look, or they're exploring.
So it's on people's radar now.
It's on people's radar much more than when it started. We were like, when we went there, there was no one. And we're a bit of unique because we're local and non-local at the same time, whereas we had a few early stage investors. Now there are other local VC firms as well, but you don't have anything beyond Series A. You have no Series B, you have no late stage capital. Now I have to give it to Bangladeshi entrepreneurs to be savvy in terms of trying to find ways. And if one door closes, you open the window. And if not, you save the chimney is the way to get in. So they've been able to reach out to investors in the US, in Scandinavia, in the Middle East. They even went like going to Pakistan or Singapore or Hong Kong, wherever they can find them.
And presumably India as well.
So there are a few, I have to say, credit to a handful of early stage India investors who have done transactions in Bangladesh, but they're not that many. It's not actually the main group. I think the main group will be Singapore.
Interesting.
As a pot. And then, again, funny enough, to some degree, the US and the Middle East.
Yeah. I mean, presumably, India is an example. I guess there's sufficient volume of deal flow in India itself that they're occupied, but again, like, it seems odd to me that if there is a thriving ecosystem on your doorstep that is hungry for capital and you have entrepreneurs building stuff, why wouldn't you look at it?
I think the depth and the scale is not comparable with India.
Got it.
I think Indian VCs are busy enough.
Yeah,
and it's probably hard when you're used to such a large market to look at what's adjacent. As a, let's say, early stage investment strategy, if it's for an expansion or an acquisition, which is more portfolio management and operations later on, maybe they should. We would welcome them. I think that's something we've always been told by others. Oh, but what about the Indians coming, walking over? And that's not the reality, at least from a startup perspective. Are there synergies? I do believe so. I mean, West Bengal is a huge market. I mean, if you look at India, it's like 10 Bangladesh. So you want to have an 11th added to it? Listen, totally up to them, and we would welcome them. But there might be some barriers in terms of perception as well. I don't know if it's a question of because they're used to it or Bangladeshis kind of not trying too hard in India, or maybe they should, or I don't know.
There's a cultural perspective.
There's a cultural perspective layer to it.
Yeah.
But I think that there is down the line, there will be probably opportunities there. I know from other early stage Indian investors that have had success in Bangladesh, so that exists. I mean, Peak 15 has done investments.
Got it.
Now we welcome the other ones.
Yeah. And so then, looking forward to Vietnam, Philippines, do you see those as similar kind of markets? Is there something that you've learned from Bangladesh that you can kind of transport into those regions as well?
So we've always had the view that we would have to go somewhere else. And Bangladesh was a green field. Probably the competition was not the same, but you're not competing for that much either. Like, in comparison to another market where you have like 2 to 5x the amount of companies, and also the amount of players, it's a different story on, oh, well, getting on the right deals, be working with the founders early on. But we felt as a market, if you look at Philippines and Vietnam in terms of size of GDP, actually Bangladesh is slightly in front of those two, which is not the first idea you have in mind. But the population is larger, right? 170. In Bangladesh, you're at over 110 million in Philippines, around 100 in Vietnam. Obviously, the societies are different, the cultures are different, but the dynamics of those markets are similar.
Similar, yeah.
And the problems people face are very similar.
Mm.
If you're unable to transact, if you're unable to purchase or move around or send your kids to school the way you want to or be able to send a thing across the border, it's the same problem.
Yeah.
It's just faced by different people in a slightly different geography, but purchasing power is pretty similar.
Mm-hmm.
The distribution of wealth within the populations is not the same.
Mm-hmm.
Philippines is most unequal society in Asia.
Yeah.
It's not India, it's actually the Philippines. Yeah. Oh, they're pretty close. I mean, we can debate that, but that's not for here. Then you would have Bangladesh and then you have Vietnam. Now, obviously, they have different styles of governance. You have a communist country. You have a socialist-inspired one. And then you have one who's a bit more Western inspired, who had an influence of the US, part of its history. Now, the ease of doing business in the Philippines, at first glance, is bigger, right? You can come as a foreigner and start a company, and you can see non-locals on management positions across
companies. Lots of Australians, Americans, etc.
Germans, people from everywhere. Yeah. I think they welcome that. Now, it's also the culture and their history that also shapes how people do business. So you have that. Bangladesh, at first glance, you might say, well, it's pretty tough. Also, Bangladeshis are welcoming. It's just probably not that easy to adapt.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also a question of language. You can kind of get around to some degree in the Philippines. In Bangladesh, you can also speak English. Now in Vietnam, it's a bit more difficult.
It's harder.
Yeah. And I think that's fine. These are realities we need to accept. But if we look at the use cases, the market sizes, they're all similar. Now, we've backed companies that were locally, had a local focus only. Now, building national champions is great. That was the wave of companies we saw that started a decade ago.
Mm-hmm.
Great. I don't think that's the future. Mm-hmm. Again, as I told you, if there is a problem you're facing in your country that's also happening next door, it's not that it's so different. So actually, if you build a solution for that problem,
you can transport it.
But the touch point with customer will be different. And that's about on the founder to be savvy. Instead of like, I accept that my reality in my town, in my village, is this. It's different than Philippines or likewise in Bangladesh. Mm-hmm. How do I address that need? How do I solve this problem? What resonates to the audience?
Yeah.
I think it's being able to think like that.
It's not only just localizing in terms of language or whatever, but it's actually understanding the cultural dynamics.
Exactly.
And I guess the user flow, right? Which may be different from...
It might change a bit. Maybe you should change your name.
Yeah, yeah.
And why? Because you have a local name in one. You can, again, it doesn't change the company and what it's doing, nor its perception.
It's just marketing brand.
It's marketing brand, and also being, again, you need to be able to communicate with the people that you're trying to address. Now, another aspect is obviously depending on what you're building, there's also rules and regulation. It's not that it's the far, far east in terms of you can be cowboys and do whatever you want. No, not at all. There are actually rules that are different in each market, but that, again, you would look at the right partners and the right investors and people to hire on the ground to help you navigate. And that's the first thing to do. And that's where we want to help out, like in terms of using our networks in each geography to help our founders accelerate and build that beachhead.
And it's building that local experience and expertise around it. So, I mean, Razor itself has a four pillar strategy, right? So climate, cross-border trade, future of commerce and embedded finance. In Southeast Asia, Bangladesh. And Bangladesh itself faces the potential of having 40 million climate refugees by mid-century. And With 15 million people a year joining the middle class in Bangladesh, commerce and finance are clearly important sectors to focus on. So does Razor look at these pillars as interconnected? And which of these excites you personally the most?
That's an excellent question. So I think the climate emergency is a reality in Bangladesh. And now, probably the way it's been perceived in the media, part of that negative loop of news that Bangladesh has always been tied to, it's not really... There are two things. One is climate adaptation. So they have already adapted to that reality. They know that this is happening. There is no denying it. So I think that already helps in terms of how
locally,
you're dealing...
Locally, there's no denying it.
Yeah, exactly. So for example, when we went to meet some of the farmers when I doing the due diligence, and I farmer went to one of the next to Joshore on the western side of Bangladesh, I asked them, okay, what are your needs? Like, as a farmer, I understand that this company here is trying to help you. What do you want? Like, I want insurance. Like, okay, against what? Against climate. I'm like, oh my God. Like, if that's the if that's the awareness, if someone who has, we can say, doesn't have a PhD or barely finished high school or anything, and their first need, they know the reality in which they have to deal with, then maybe we need to probably pay more attention to that. Mm-hmm. Now, the fact that there are floods has been reality of that. They have their own system, their warning systems, etc. The one question is, okay, do you just live the consequences out, or can you go further? I think you've had, in terms of architecture, in terms of health and support network, for a country that is so dense with such a high risk on people's lives, they're doing a pretty good job. Especially if you look at what's been happening to Spain.
Which has been crazy. So we're recording this, I think, a week after these massive floods in southern Spain, in Valencia, especially, where we saw, what, I think, a year's worth of rain drop in overnight, yeah, essentially.
And I think that also probably shapes people's perception, and they know the urgency of things. Now, sometimes you have to compromise and you've been put in that position because climate is one reality of people's life, but it's not the only one. So why I'm saying they've adapted to it is because probably they didn't have a choice.
Yeah.
Because you cannot have climate justice without socio-economical justice at the same time. You cannot tell people, or don't consume, or don't do that. But they're ready to do it in a different way if the option is given to them. It's not like, oh no, I just want to burn coal. That's not the mentality nor the attitude. I think they probably
If you give me the means to build solar, I'll build solar.
Yeah. And they probably use more solar than Spain. If we're doing a pure comparison on that level, or some other parts of the world, because it's cheaper, and they know that they don't need to build an infrastructure that we have probably here, or that we're used to. Like, let's say, okay, full-fledged, we need to get cable going. We need to this and that. No, you can't even connect. You have remote villages and parts of the country that are connected, that are able to have their own source of energy, and it's not about having a furnace. Now, I think the risk of 40 million climate refugees is a thing. Will that happen? That's a whole different question, because they're not sitting there idly waiting for this to happen. So people are working towards that, and I think there are some countries, in particular the Netherlands, who've trying to bring also their know-how. Now, in terms of perceived risk on the market, I would ask you the question, would you invest in the Netherlands?
Would I? Yeah, I would.
Yeah, well, technically, the Netherlands is underwater.
Is at risk,
And they have the technology, and they've built the infrastructure to allow them to have a peaceful kind of life in terms of being protected from nature. Bangladesh just don't have that luxury, but they have the ability, and they also can protect themselves from that. So will that be a real risk of regarding investment? I wouldn't say no, but you should probably look at people trying to solve that problem, because there's an opportunity there. Now, going beyond the region, we all have a glamorized view probably of Indonesia, the Philippines, and Vietnam. We all have those great beaches in mind, and yes, they're fantastic. But we need to keep them that way. We need to protect them, and we need to protect the environment and the ecosystems. But it's not just the duty of the locals. They're already doing their fair part. At the same time, the locals are ready to do an even larger effort, right? Now, actually, that part of the world are a net climate victim. Like, it's their ecosystems that are the most damaged as part of the region.
So, what is the barrier for them? Is the barrier, again, is it capital? Is it education? Is it infrastructure? Is it government policy?
A mix. Yeah. There's a mix. I cannot say it's just one for one country. Or the other. I think what you can witness is that sometimes there's discrepancies between what we think the problem is mm-hmm. and what the reality is on the ground. That is as applicable from someone sitting here talking about this, but you need to be on the ground. So when you go on the ground and when you meet the people, you realize, okay, well, actually, we would love to use the nicer, greener, climate-friendly solution, but it doesn't work here. Why? Well, it needs more electricity. We do not produce that amount of electricity. We will use we use e-scooters, more e-scooters probably than, and we're ready to even use many more. Because it's a new type of product, I'm not getting a loan from the bank because they don't know how to underwrite the cost.
Well, I mean, that's not just a problem in Bangladesh. I mean, we worked with a company recently here in the UK which had developed the first road-safe e-scooter technology. They weren't able to launch and commercialize. Why? Because insurers, it needed to be road ready with insurance, and insurers wouldn't underwrite. Right?
So, as everywhere else, you need the stakeholders to align. Now, there is another risk, and the 15 million middle classes across those four countries, more or less. So, we're expecting 150 million new consumers at middle class level across those geographies. If they all consume the way they still are, or we are. Probably because they're
The aspiration is
Western. Then we have a massive problem because not only will be they net climate victims, which they already are, but they're big net contributors as well.
Problem, yeah.
And I think we have a once in a lifetime opportunity to work with those younger population as well, who are much more aware, like hat off to the Gen Zs, that make the right choice in terms of consumption. And the options are coming up. Like, people are ready to be more conscious about their surrounding, their environments. And that also is a reality in those markets, as long as you can show them that there is value in doing so and that they're not the only one. Like, as long as it's not a loss to them in terms of quality of service and anything else.
You don't want this sort of degrowth narrative, right? Like, where stop consuming because that's the only way you're going to, you know. So this has been the rhetoric, I think, from certain elements of the West, where it's like, okay, you look at developing economies, whether that's Africa, whether that's in Asia or whatever, and it's like, well, okay, we've got a climate crisis. Well, we've got all of these aspiring middle class coming through. Actually, we need to stop their consumption. So we've had our consumption. You guys need to hold back now because otherwise we're going to have a real crisis, which is not fair.
It's not fair. It's not just. Clearly, that would be privilege talking.
Yeah.
And we are sitting here, we're in a place, again, we're very privileged. Now, at the same time, can we offer better alternatives so that they don't do the same mistakes our societies have done? Yes, but that's on us. That's not on them.
Mm.
So if we want to lead by example, then we should implement those changes.
As well, yeah.
As well, and then we can go and preach. But beyond the preaching part, I think people are willing to do things differently. For example, you will find no plastic straws,
mm-hmm.
which is a very basic thing, but they know that this impacts the flora and the fauna of where they are. They have been much more radical into implementing it than what you find here. And it's just an example, right? There are plenty of other policies or other rules that can be put in place. Now, the governments also know that they need to go into that direction. And on top of it, they can benefit from it.
Yeah.
Why? If you think about Philippines and Indonesia, for example, they have reserves of nickel,
mm-hmm.
which is needed to for battery technology. And the rest of the world depends on them being able to extract that as well. But not
otherwise, there's over-reliance on China, etc.
Well, that's already moving. Even the Chinese players are going into Indonesia because there are other opportunities. We should pay attention. We should maybe also work with them.
Mm-hmm.
Not say, okay, we have fancy technology here. there is a middle ground to make it work for everyone. Now, you can have the best technology, but going back to your question earlier, that's not enough. Okay, we can have the most energy efficient, CO2 reducing solution. It's about the application and how it's adopted in the market. So how do you adopt it? First thing is being able to get to scale. So to get to scale, you need distribution. Mm. So how do you distribute in a market like that? Most people have no idea.
Yeah.
And the networks on which they depend are historical networks. It's like, well, you distributed like basic commodities or SKUs as a grocer or something else, or you're the one selling construction material. Therefore, I also distribute solar panels. There are ways around that, but you need to have a local understanding. Mm. And you need to realize that, again, that fulfills a local need. If it doesn't fulfill the local need, it was a nice to have. Mm. It was not really solving a problem. Now, maybe sometimes even it's the size of physical size of things. If you do 1/10 of the size, people will use it.
Yep.
If it's too big, it's not like they cannot put it on their scooter and travel with it because there's no van that was going to get to their village. You need to be savvy on those points.
Like, you need to understand the local market exactly well enough. Yeah.
Now, okay, let's say we've solved for the technology and distribution. Great. Now, the last point is going to be about value and the perception of value. The strategy of a lot of players, let's say, that come from China and the US and other, wherever they come from, into those markets was it's all about price. And the cheaper, the better. Therefore, because I'm playing a volume game and I want everybody to get my product, it compresses your margin as well. Huh? It's not always a good business. If you have the capacity of production, yes, you get the economies of scale. But if you look at, let's say, your point here is not, I don't want to serve 100 million people in buying and eating the same thing. I do want them to have, like, what we can sustain is a growth of a reach of a population of 10 million and offer that service. Therefore, because there's a limited supply, the price should be higher. And people, if they understand that, they will pay the higher price because their incomes are increasing. Their purchasing power is increasing. So the way the budget and what they're willing to spend to, especially if it's related to something that makes them look good and perceived as good, they will do it. They will not compromise. Now, another aspect, and that's for all our product designers and people who look into behavior to really focus on those challenges, but those users are not dumb. Like they see that, okay, I have the cheap one now. It's probably because I need it. The other fancy one or is too fancy and is not marketed to me, or I'm ready to pay a dollar more, 20% more, but show me why.
Yeah. Where is the value
exactly
in the additional price point? Yeah.
So that's the next step. And then the last one, which we are very privileged to have, is you can use a credit card. Mm. That's fine. Mm. You're not, and the cost of using credit is also controlled, right? Nobody's taking really advantage of you anymore. Those days are over. And that's not the case. Most of people do not have a bank account with a card.
Mm.
They have a wallet maybe that they can use and do something with it. But the last frontier of that, let's say if you sold for the first three, is like, okay, how do we pay for it? Mm-hmm. Are there products, like financial products that can be used mm-hmm. to reduce the cost? Are there ways of paying over time that will allow you, for example...
Yeah, so I was thinking buy now, pay later.
But even without going the route of the BNPL, because some people lost a lot of money doing that for in sure. those markets, is more about even in terms of concessions on how you do your contracts.
Mm.
If you go up the supply chain to be able, again, we're talking about the EV mobility play where they didn't get the approval from the insurers.
Yeah.
It's everybody has to play ball at some point. Now, I have another company that I've spoken to. So they were doing something very interesting in Vietnam. They were adapting sand battery technology. I don't know if you've heard of that. It comes from Finland.
Okay.
And it's often used in industrial settings. It's large. So it stores thermal energy. I'm simplifying. the same principle of a radiator, right? Yeah. Put that with... rods of carbon composites that store heat and with sand all over instead of air, like a huge box like that. So you can store
the
thermal
sand
energy.
Sand is an insulator, presumably.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. So that's very basic. So they've applied that to a local setting in rural Vietnam. And what does that mean? So let's think about the coffee and the tea we drink, right? With, you know, like organic, whatever. But are we considering the cost of energy that is used to dry this coffee and tea?
Dry and transport then, yeah.
Yeah, but there's mostly the dry. So the way it's today, coffee is dried is by a furnace, which is the worst thing ever because it's wood logs and coal.
Yep.
And it's constantly burning. So yeah, we probably need to look at the CO2 emissions of the coffee we're buying. But
I'll wait for the next CO2 carbon credit platform to
take advantage of that. But what these gents have done is they were able to use that to store it so that it's not wasted. And you can either plug in the grid or solar to do so, right? That's grid impact straight away. Now, lovely. They do the software and the hardware. They're ready to give it to people and front some of the costs. And so you do a pay as you use, because most farmers and others would love to use this product, but they don't have the ability to pay for it and go straight away. And you assume, okay, I'm not going to give it to the customer. I will need to find a way to finance it myself and find a leasing system. And then I get paid regularly. And that would be totally fine. Now, financial institutions were interested. I'm like, okay, let's say that you have probably a potential of contracts for a few million in terms of production. So it's an interesting contract. The interest, people are willing to pay. The math adds up. Everything's fine. They're just like, well, we don't know if there's a warranty on your product. If that breaks apart. So we are unable to understand how, like, how to even formulate and underwrite a loan.
Yeah.
Or
because we don't know what the risk is.
Exactly. Yeah. So, again, this is a straight impact. Pretty straightforward. There is no catch here. I mean, obviously, SimpleMind is an example. But it shows that when the, let's say, the financial institution locally cannot do it, maybe we can help. Maybe there is an opportunity to come in. And I think that's worthy of exploring. Now, we should not be the one telling them what to do, but we should enable them at solving like those four pillars I was highlighting.
Yeah. So it's capital as a means to unlock the opportunities within there. So you're not just, so you're funding the innovation as well as the business, essentially.
Exactly.
But you're enabling that innovation in a market which is otherwise immature financially, where otherwise these technologies cannot prosper. It's super interesting. We're going to change tack quite significantly for a second, right? Because one of my biggest big bugbears over the last few years, and certainly anyone who's listened to this podcast more than once will understand this, but it's been this sort of surfeit of venture dollars that flooded into 15 million grocery delivery startups. And my CFO brain really just couldn't see how the business model made any sense, any kind of sense, I guess, outside of some very specific niche use cases. But you invested in Chaldal, which is the largest grocery platform in Bangladesh, who seem to have made the model work, right? So much so that they're fast evolving into a comprehensive food and grocery ecosystem throughout the country. So why does it work there but not here?
Okay, well, first, I always was perplexed as well on why it makes sense in that environment and why it would make sense here. And all the delivery options that exist. I think I'm the generation who kind of saw how we could start order food online and I probably abused it a bit. The takeaway.coms and I mean Just Eat. I've used Just Eat. Probably some people these days even haven't used such a platform.
I don't think I've used Just Eat. Yeah, I used Deliveroo or whatever, but yeah.
So I think the restaurant to home experience was always a problem that people wanted to tackle. Now, most people haven't thought of supermarket to home as a milestone that needed to be conquered. Certainly
in these regions, in the UK, etc., because you have large supermarkets with large parking lots and, relatively accessible. There's a supermarket every 5 minutes. Whereas in countries like Bangladesh, presumably it's still lots and lots of small.
So it's a different experience. Right? Yeah. So I think they don't have like your, I mean, I don't want to mention the big names here, but
you can mention the
Tesco's with their large strategies. Okay, it's huge supermarkets. You can park. You have something else going on the side, and they open until late. That's their strategy. Probably you'll find a Sainsbury, which will go into a different neighborhood, different size, different SKUs. And everybody has a share of the market, and they're more or less growing, but within, let's say, an expected like trajectory. Now, if you want to go and just say, hey, well, let's get rid of the real estate, there's a company that was around back in the day called Webvan. So probably some people have not paid attention of the existence of that company. Mm-hmm. Got a lot of dollars as well, and pure e-commerce boom in the 90s. Worth looking into what happened there. At the time, the two darlings, I mean, Amazon had just started a bit earlier, and then you had the Webvan. And the thought was, well, you need the infrastructure to be at the back end. The experience is about how you pick and everything. And it's true. It was the real problems were how you pick and how quickly you get that done to get the order through and delivery to your place. Now, that... from an operation standpoint, yes, it's the right way of thinking about it. Now, you need to also know how to get the experience right for people and knowing what you pay for and what your strategy and your view is. Now, when we looked at the opportunity in Bangladesh, there was no space for warehouses. That's the first problem. You could have very nice like warehouses that we have that are last mile, that are a hot item because, yes, there's you get it close to a customer, but... you're in a place where you're in a city, for example, in Dhaka, it's over 20 million people. The land is expensive, especially compared to the income people have.
Presumably, it's very built up high as opposed to...
they try, but to certain places. But again, we need to consider it's swampland, not everywhere. So those are priced. Now, Chalda was smart enough to figure out how to run smaller units with a higher number of SKUs. The promise there was not 15 minutes. They did try at some point, but it was end up being more a case of showing off that they can do it. There is no business value to it because you're in a net, as you said, CFO hat on. If you're using your rider for a specific trip, then you're just burning money.
Yeah, utilization is like...
exactly. So it's great. Will you pay 100% premium to get in 15 minutes? But that's something to consider then as an offering. Nobody will go to the market.
And that's what would work in the UK or in more developed economies because it's a premium product.
Exactly. Right? Now, in Bangladesh, there you have a few supermarkets, but you have also your local stores. Now, for some people, they have staff, house staff. People will go and buy something for them. Now, you never know what's available and not available. You leave them a sum of cash, they go buy it, bring it back, and... I hope most people get the right amount of cash back or anything. It's a question of trust, right? Yeah. The way how Chalda comes in is like we're building trust with the customer that whatever you want, A, we show it's available or not, so there's no surprise. And when it's available, we can guarantee it's real. It's not a fake or anything else. We work with the right suppliers. The experience is going to be smooth. And now let's talk about there's traffic in London, but not really. Dhaka is one of the worst traffics in the world. It's probably in the top five globally in terms of how bad it is to move around. So imagine you wanted to do your grocery shopping for your family for the week. You need an hour just to get there. Yeah. You have to navigate and see what's available, what's not available. Then you need another hour to come home. That whole experience was painful. It's over 3 hours. Mm-hmm. If someone, you can say, okay, I can get a delivery in an hour's time at home.
That's life-changing.
Life-changing. So that made sense. Now, then we said, okay, but how many people can actually, how many of those are there? Okay, that's a use case specific to, let's say, a family, middle class. What about others? So we did the work and we looked at, okay, if you do from a 15-minute radius in terms of delivery on a scooter, because we have scooters, we have smaller vans, how many people do you cover? How many households can you cover? I think... on average, a warehouse of us covers over 200,000 people.
Wow, so dense.
In terms, it's a very dense. So if you know that that density is present, okay, then it's something else. And then figuring out in terms of SKU what to bring to the smaller warehouse, because you figure out, okay, these people here, they like to order the crisps in this way, and they want the local mango and they don't want the fancy mango. Why would you offer it? Like, you're able to do it. Now we're also able to do that with, even we've tested fish, we can deliver fresh fish.
Wow.
Now it will be available in the morning, not all day, because just in terms of how much you can stock and the demand, we can also do it with meat, and we do pretty well with fresh vegetables and fruits. Now, if you can do it in this way, nothing is stopping you. Although, now the question becomes, how do you make it seamless,
mm-hmm.
right? The problem is everybody gets used to a certain level of standard. We get customer complaints as well, right? It's normal, like, you're out of stock. It's not what I wanted. What do you get? And that's, again, gets back to the Webonan example I made in terms of getting the experience right.
Mm-hmm.
If the experience would be amazing, you and I would just use on Amazon Prime, all fresh. There's also a reason why they have physical stores as well, and why they bought Whole Foods. There is a dynamic needed to figure out.
Well, part of that is trust. Part of that is understanding what market buys from them and what they're after.
And there's experience. Sometimes you walk by, footfall does still exist. Exactly. And what we also found out is in a market like Bangladesh or a player like Chaldal, you can do much more than just foods. The moment the first layer of trust with your population, with your audience, is I made a promise in terms of bringing you food that
most
you will
basic
want.
Item.
Most basic item. Yeah. It works. It's online. You paid for it online. Everything works online. You trust online. Online is a reality. I think we covered over 2 million households
mm-hmm. Wow.
That have been with us. We have around 10% that are active users every month. The trend is not that they will be on it every day, like, oh, Deliveroo, I need to order some food at mine. It's a different type of use.
Mm.
The basket sizes are a bit smaller, but they're not incredibly smaller. And I think if you go in a model like this, I think that you can get to profitability easily. It's not impossible. Ocado made it work. And in terms of margin, we're not like we can get to similar targets.
Mm-hmm.
And this is just by operating in a couple of cities.
Mm-hmm.
Now, like in every market, there are ups and downs. I think the next challenge here is find the added value and the improve the user experience, making more personalized. And then one thing we've been trying, and which is pretty interesting, we found a personal shopper solution.
Okay.
For our premium users. They're like, okay, I can call. I can, like, hey, this is what I need. Get my order through. Like, I don't even have, like, if you want to make it as direct and satisfying for your user, you can't, like.
I mean, it's incredible, right? Because so that just that personal shopper, you know, you mentioned it right at the beginning there. That is the norm for people to have someone who's helping in the house, and they will go and do the shopping. So essentially what they've done is recreated that experience with a personal shopper, essentially in the same way, right? Like, but online and then delivered. Right?
Yeah, the thing is, probably the person who you're using a personal shopper cannot afford the staff. So we are also getting people that want the aspirational experience and they're not part of the same social bracket.
Yeah, so
they feel like,
mobile.
Hey, I can get help.
Yeah, yeah.
Like you, if you look at the average spend, it's around $15
mm-hmm.
As a basket. It does, there are a wider audience of people. And I think the other point is, because we're able to do a certain volume, we can compete in terms of pricing too.
Yeah.
It's not, there are not 55 Tescos over there. There are one or two players.
Saw a statistic at one point, right? Given all of the various products that Tesco sells, not just grocery, but financial, mobile, all the rest of it, they take something like 50 pence out of every pound spent in the UK goes to Tesco. Some crazy number like that, right? You clearly don't have that sort of a behemoth that just commands the market.
I think the largest player is Shopno. They should be around 200, $300 million in revenue at this point, just assuming.
Yeah.
But that's in a country of 170 million people.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So it's completely fractured.
Yeah, there's a market available.
Gazillions of middlemen and layers. And now there we can, and we don't expect everybody to use us, right? But we have the operational and logistical background to make it happen, even for others to partner with us. And yeah. I think by getting the right volumes, being able to get that, the customer at the end of the day will benefit from it.
Yeah.
And that's a promise we make. We're never going to overcharge them more than what the market's giving at the, on any product.
Yeah. And that essentially, again, to your point, that operational plan and know-how is what you can then quote unquote franchise out to other regions, right? To your earlier point, you call it a different, you know, you don't call it Chaldal in the Philippines, you call it something else, but you take that playbook essentially and you set up the infrastructure to work with the local population. And the local population in the Philippines, maybe they don't have the need for the personal shopper, but they have a need for something else. And you just, you work around that. Okay. So 15 minute grocery delivery doesn't necessarily work there either. That's actually good to know. I'm glad.
You're reassured.
Yeah, I'm very reassured. So look, we're going to round off now with one kind of quick question. What is one thing that you have a contrarian conviction about from any area of life, whether that's work, politics, social, or at home? What is a hill that you would die on defending?
That's a very good question. Like, I didn't expect that one. I think it's in general, I mean, maybe in certain cultures in which we operate, it's not common to be able or be allowed to lose face in public.
Mm-hmm.
So I would particularly target that audience and say, for that market, it would be very contrarian to say, well, actually, I was wrong. And being able to own up to your own mistakes and being public and vocal about it and in a candid way actually is a strength.
Yeah, I'm a firm believer in that. Yeah,
And it might sound natural to both of us here and not that crazy as an idea, but it goes against the grain on how those cultures are wired.
I've worked with people from Southeast Asia for the last 20 years, and without... I don't want to broad brush and kind of paint everyone with the same brush, but especially within sales, although that may just be salespeople all over, but generally people were more willing to say yes when they knew that they couldn't deliver and then fail at delivering than say, no, I can't deliver for fear of looking bad at the outset. But I'm a firm believer, like always, your mistakes are what define you, right? Like, it's not your successes. It's where you failed and what you learned, right? And being able to actually say, actually, you know what, I messed up here. To your point, in my mind, it's a sign of self-assurance and of confidence, right? That you're able to do that. And it's definitely a shame that doesn't happen more. Afshin,
I have last one.
Yeah,
that
no,
came
please.
Back.
Yeah,
so yeah. That's as part of my founder's experience.
Yeah.
We can pick which one you prefer, but there is no financial benefit in being right.
There is no financial, yeah, okay.
And you can be a smart entrepreneur, you know how to solve a problem, you probably found a better way of solving that problem for your customer, mm-hmm. and you're right, yes, it is true. But if the customer is not willing to pay you, there's zero benefit to that.
Yeah.
So I think that's one of the best life lessons as a founder.
Well, that's the build it and they will come mentality, right? Like, if I can just build a better mousetrap, they'll arrive at my doorstep. Afshin, it's been absolutely amazing having you on the podcast. Thank you so much for your time. For our audience, where can they find you online? Are you on LinkedIn? Are you on Twitter?
Twitter I probably haven't used, or X, in a very long time, so don't add me there. Okay. I don't think. But yeah, I'm on LinkedIn. You'll find me under my name. To reach out. They're always happy to connect with you.
Amazing. We will add those in the show notes as well. But for the time being, Afshin, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate you coming down.
Thank you, Arish. It was fun.